How will generative AI impact work, and why are smaller companies adopting generative AI more than enterprises? Hello and welcome to Tech First. My name is John Gutierrez. Generative AI, we know, I mean, it's obvious, is almost literally exploding. There's so many possibilities, new tools coming up every single day. How is it changing our everyday work, the businesses we work at? We're going to dive into that. Recently, GBK Collective, a consultancy founded by top academics at Wharton, studied 672 businesses in the U.S. with annual sales over $50 million. We're going to get a sneak peek into what they learned. Joining us today are two of the authors, Dr. Stefano Pontoni, professor of marketing at the Wharton Youth School and co-director of AI at Wharton. We're going to dive into why he holds both those roles. That's pretty cool. And we also have Jeremy Korst, who's a former Microsoft and T-Mobile exec. I believe he led the rollout of Windows 10. So just a tiny little role, no big deal. Former Microsoft and T-Mobile exec, now president of GBK Collective. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Really pumped to have you guys. Stefano, I said it right in the intro. Got to dive into that. You're professor of marketing and you're co-director of AI. That sounds pretty unique. Talk about that.
I am a behavioral scientist, so the kind of work I do, I really study individual behavior, and I'm studying consumers. How do people make decisions, how users interact with technology, what kind of experience they have as they, you know, play around with the stuff that we have today. And that's changing consumption in many, many ways, and over time, I've basically got more and more interested in the topic of automation and AI. And so this year, we are setting up this new center called AI at Wharton, pulling together everything AI across the Wharton School. Every department is involved. We have a fantastic lineup of researchers, projects, and I think a super exciting opportunity to be able to do that.
Very, very cool. Jeremy, let's go super high level with the report. Give us a top level. What did you learn?
Yeah, so what we wanted to do, you know, first of all, you know, at GBK, one of the things we get to do a lot is work with top academics and industry leaders and some of the work we do. And, you know, Stefano, like Stefano and some of his colleagues. And so we've been engaged in talking about, you know, some of the predictions about the use of AI at work and in other factors. And essentially, what we saw missing was some look on, well, what's actually happening today? And so I had to engage in the study. And so we ended up interviewing over 600 business decision makers from a range of industries and functions in the study. And, you know, what we found is that, you know, there's a range of options, but, you know, overall, well more than half of these business decision makers are using AI in some type of context, you know, at various levels of frequency. And so, you know, we were, you know, frankly, a bit surprised at the level of adoption in some areas.
I want to go to, I think, the real big question right away. And then I want to dive into some of the aspects of the study and, you know, what confirmed suspicions, what changed, you know, some of your ideas, industries that are using the most, the least, some of the implications of that. But I want to ask the real big question that's on my mind. And I think it's on a lot of people's minds right up front. What is work going to look like in 5 or 10 years? And I'm going to contextualize that a little bit. And I want both of you to speak on that. But, you know, the thing that comes to mind when we think about generative AI, ChatGPT, Siri, Alexa, that sort of stuff, maybe it's just my generation. Maybe it's just me. I don't know. I think, you know, sort of Iron Man, Jarvis, right? And, you know, here's this dude and he's got this Jarvis, this almost sentient AI turns out to be basically sentient, does almost all the work. He just tells it what he wants and it does all the heavy lifting. Is that where we're going? What's the future look like with the generative AI stuff that you're looking at right now? Maybe Stefano, you start.
If I had a very strong and confident answer to that question, I probably would not be a professor, I would assume. But all I can say, I think, is that we've never had something like generative AI. If you think about automation in the past, and even very recent past, it's been about making things easier and helping us freeing time and capacity to do thinking. You know, removing routine tasks, removing manual tasks, and letting us free to do, say, moving from, you know, blue collar jobs to white collar jobs, and increasingly thinking more about, you know, how do you serve customers, how do you improve things, and taking maybe spending less time on repetitive things like, you know, paperwork and stuff like that. And that's thanks to technology. But this technology is different in that it automates higher order cognitive functions. So now it's thinking. And it's not thinking in a very basic way, like, you know, summing numbers in an Excel file. That's thinking too, of some sort. But this is thinking in a way that we tended until now, basically, to assume this is something only humans can do. And actually it turned out not to be the case. And so we don't know where this is going to go, how much better it's going to be. What we can tell already now is that this thing doesn't have to get any better for it to be transformative. It's already good enough to change lots and lots of things that we care about. So I think that's something that I think everybody needs to realize, that it's not the technology around the corner, it's in front of us. And so we need to learn what it can do. And the big bottleneck is not going to be really the technology. It's going to be understanding what to do with it. You know, the deployment of the technology to improve workflows, to change the way we think about certain business processes, and maybe re-engineering completely business functions. You can imagine it'll take probably 20 years before we figure out what they can do for organizations.
Yeah, I think, yeah, John, like the budget I'm just agreeing with, you know, all Stefano says that, and by the way, aligned with our study, that what we found in the study that is that those who actually have used or are using generative AI today have a generally more positive view of its capabilities, whether that be in enhancing productivity, et cetera, you know, versus necessarily replacing human beings. And, you know, whether that's causal or not right now in terms of who's using it, you know, that's to be seen. I think those of us who are using it, you know, learn, like Stefano was saying, is there's a real application today. You can see the promise of it. I'm using it in my day-to-day work and life. And so I think it's really important for whether it's people who are new to the workforce or those who are even, long in the careers to really be experimenting with the technology, learning its promise today, because how we're going to, you know, figure these things out. You know, the other thing I've seen is I'm also fairly involved in the early stage technology ecosystem as an advisor and board member of several companies. And we're going through a typical hype cycle as well. I think what's a little bit different of this hype cycle is the amount of adoption that's already occurring, but the number of, unique use cases and applications and companies that are being funded right now is pretty dramatic. And I've got to believe that some of that going to, you know, it's going to shake out over time. And so I think a combination of what's going on there, as well as having business, real business users test and apply this in their day-to-day work, we're going to get dramatic change. It's going to be, in my opinion, less than that 5 or 10 year horizon. It's here now.
You mentioned hype cycle, and I want to hit Stefano on that in a moment, but it's interesting. And Jeremy, I'm going to stick with you for a second. When I've looked at young people in technology, and I'm going to try and draw a parallel here between small companies and big companies. Maybe it makes sense, maybe it doesn't, call me out, whatever you want to do. When I've seen young people use technology, they dive in, they're not afraid to make mistakes, they're not afraid to screw up, they find a way to make it work. When I see older people use technology, how does it work? I need some training. What do I do? They're terrified of making a mistake. One of the things that you saw in your study is that smaller companies were diving right in. Maybe that's because they have less resources. Maybe that's because they need it. Maybe that they're more open to change. They have less bureaucracy. Who knows what's going on there? And is there sort of a parallel there, Jeremy?
Yeah, I saw your work on generations aspect of adoption. And we saw more things in the study. In fact, we saw the highest level of usage at work between those in their mid-30s to early 40s. And then a fairly precipitous drop-off from there on. And like you said, too, as well as in terms of company maturity and age, or at least size, let's use size as a proxy for that, that while our study focused on enterprises of $50 million in sales and above, we saw the most usage and adoption in the company that were the smaller of those size. So we found some interesting things that I'd say about technology adoption and usage overall that Stefan and I will probably be following up on as it relates to things like, just like you're alluding to in terms of, innovation and adoption of technology by company size in particular.
Super interesting to keep learning as we dive farther into that. Stefano, I want to go back to you and talk about hype cycle. There is a tremendous hype cycle here. And, it's always a little concerning because we've come out of so many hype cycles. There's always a new hype cycle. We've come out of sort of Web3 and crypto hype cycle. Some people will be pissed off at me for saying we've come out of it, but let's be honest, we've come out of it. There's other hype cycles, but you said one that you mentioned is metaverse. You said this is not another metaverse. Talk about that.
What I meant to say by that is not necessarily to be dismissive about, Web3 or the metaverse, but to say a technology that has a lot of people recognize promise in it, but there isn't a lot of substance yet. And maybe that is around the corner, maybe not. In the case of metaverse, I think it's been around the corner for 20 years, let's say. But, maybe something next year will come and take everything by storm. What I meant to say by this is not another metaverse, is to say it's already happening. Just like I said, adoption is already over 50% among the top execs we've surveyed. You see business cases being, really high on, basically what we did when we were designing the survey, we came up with a very long list of use cases, some like the longest laundry list you can think of, just to see what people will be doing with it. And my expectation was that you'd see a lot of variants where a lot of use cases would be kind of, wow, really? And very low scores, while others would be maybe higher. But first, all the use cases were in fact rather high. The lowest one was still over 50%. And the most of the use cases were in the 70s, 80% of respondents counting on going for it. So basically everybody. And there were lots of them. We're talking about, Jeremy, I think there were about 20 different use cases.
Exactly.
So that's really tells you something. It's not one specific application for what type of business. It's basically a million different use cases for a million different businesses. It's got to work. Now, is it going to work for every use case for everybody? I'm sure not. Okay. And maybe we learn how to make them work even there. And it'll take some time. The technology will have to change. Maybe companies will have to change. But certainly there's going to be some very obvious low-hanging fruits that are already being picked. So it's not about next year, 2 years, 3 years. It's this year. And, on top of that, I think if you think about this technology, it's mostly going to be an enterprise technology. And so this is a technology that gets into the office. Okay, and maybe some of the hypes that you've seen, others were more consumer applications, and maybe narrower applications. And of course, there are also B2B applications for the metaverse and crypto and so forth. But a lot of the action has been more on the consumer side, which I think tends to be, showing these bigger hypes, ups and downs, maybe because there's simply more, voices and interest when it's something that, slots into people's lives directly. While this one, it's B2B, mostly it's going to be an enterprise application. Just imagine what Microsoft is going to be able to do with embedding, large language models in all kind of, productivity programs, right? So it's great, I think.
That is amazing. It's good that you bring up Microsoft because they are going full on here. Obviously, they're big investors in OpenAI. Obviously, they've got access to ChatGPT and everything that they're doing there. Google is doing similar things in terms of their productivity suite. And I mean, you are basically going to see in the very near future, if you're not already on some of the early betas, that, hey, I'll write that email for you. Hey, I'll write that note for you, that marketing pitch or something like that. And I wonder, Stefano, if you can speculate a little bit, where's the competitive advantage going to be? I've done some of this myself, where I've almost co-written some things with an AI source. So there's a lot of clients that I deal with in my personal practice, and some things I want to write entirely myself because it's entirely my voice, and I want my presentation or I want my blog post to be exactly how I would write it. In other cases, it's just a checkbox item, and I'm not passionate about it. And I need to be passionate about things that I really involve my soul in, if you want to put it that way, right? And so I'll co-write it with AI. And I wonder if the competitive advantage in the future is being able to meld the machine and the human in a way that really syncs and works. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I totally agree. So if you think about deploying generative AI in organizations, you have to worry about three elements. You've got the user, you've got the software, and you've got the integration process by which the two connect and do stuff. And if you think about, we all compete for talent, right? So that's always been the case. We try to get the best people we can get. And maybe what talent means might be slightly changing as the skills needed to get a job in this new world of generative AI might be slightly different, but essentially this we've always been fighting for. The systems, the software, basically from the point of view of the user is a bit of a commodity, meaning there's gonna be 5-6 big models and everybody's gonna be using the same one. Of course, there's gonna be some value in data, like, fine tuning the networks and finding ways to carve out maybe some competitive advantage on that side. But essentially, from the point of view of the users of these models are commodities. Everybody's got access to the same ones. So basically, I think that the third element, the integration process, is going to be where the competitive advantage is going to come from. The companies that are going to be able to learn fastest and best how to actually combine human and artificial intelligence to maximize the collective intelligence of the organization, do the thing in the smartest way. I think that is going to be what's going to get companies to win. So they got to tinker, they got to try. Every organization has got to care about this and get teams to experiment, try out things and see what it can do for you in your business, in your industry, with your customers. How can it help? Right. So nobody has a blueprint. Nobody really knows. The only thing is just rushing ahead and try things out. With some, with some compliance and some, the support from whatever, make sure that you do things right, and then just learn.
I love that some compliance, and the people who are in banking and the people who are in healthcare. What? And they're going to have big issues, but they need it, especially healthcare. We need a lot of AI in healthcare to deliver outcomes. Jeremy, I want you to continue the thoughts that Stefano was talking about there, because. He's right. We're going to have these big models. We're going to take them in. I think there's going to be some value in verticalizing them for specific industries. But I also wonder, and I'm getting ahead of ourselves right now because it's going beyond maybe a couple of years where we are right now. I also wonder to what extent companies will own kind of their AI in a sense. And clearly it's going to be built by somebody, but they want to have it sandboxed. They want to have it. And how companies have always struggled with continuity of process as people change, continuity of knowledge as people shift out of roles and leave the company. And how do you see, will a company have an AI that kind of manages its knowledge and processes, and will that grow over time? Getting very sci-fi here.
Yeah, but being, along the lines of both you were talking, we look at the enterprise use case, of which I agree is going to be the primary driver of overall adoption and use of this. The concerns we've seen in other studies and heard up from our clients as well as we saw in our own study were very relevant things like compliance, whether it's IP ownership. You saw what IBM did this week, announcing that they were going to unveil more data around what they were actually what IP they were training their AI against. We have concerns about privacy of both proprietary company information as well as PII for customers. All of those things lend themselves to some of these big areas that understand enterprise, and be it Microsoft or Google, to be able to create the winning solution in this space. I spent half of my life in B2B and half in B2B in terms of marketing and product management. And I agree with you, John. I do think that where we will see some opportunity for vendors is in more special purpose and just industry or use case or job to be done, application to make this more whether from a compliance side with things like HIPAA and, you know, SOC 2, et cetera, or, you know, make it applicable to various areas of those industries.
It is interesting. Salesforce is another company in this space. And I recently was at Dreamforce and I saw some of their things. They literally put artificial general intelligence on one of their slides. Yeah. Literally put, and there's a strong belief, Mark Benioff, CEO, strong belief that the companies with the best AI will win in the future. And that is really interesting. We've always talked about human talent. Can you get the best human talent? Now, can you also pair that with the best artificial talent, artificial intelligence? Super interesting. We can't go into all the aspects there, but it is kind of mind expanding, mind blowing to think about what that might look like in 5, 10, 15, even 20 years. Who knows?
Yeah.
Jeremy, if you look at the study you did, what confirmed some of your suspicions going in, and maybe what contradicted some of your preconceived ideas?
Well, we thought, you know, I do study innovation and options just in general from my academic background and some of the work I've done. And so when I thought of things like we've already talked about perhaps smaller, more nimble enterprises being earlier on the adoption curve, validated some things that, you know, I may have guessed. Other things like when we look at in terms of industry, technology and finance, and it was also earlier on the adoption curve, not that surprising. A surprising thing, and perhaps because we didn't look at the legal department specifically, was that the application of large language models to legal profession ranked one of the lower, in fact, the lowest on the 20 use cases we had, although, like Stefano said, it was over 50%. That was, you know, been a surprise. And then, you know, with generally, you know, also in terms of functional, we found that, you know, things like marketing and sales were a little bit, let's say, later on the adoption curve compared to some other functions like technology, which, of course, the technology team and the procurement team not being that surprising. So that's, but going back to what I said initially, where I was a bit surprised at just seeing that, you know, 58% of decision makers, you know, across functions have been using AI at some level, large language models, generative AI, within their work. And so I would have lost that bet.
Interesting. On the legal stuff, that's also super interesting because we know that there's some AI lawyers out there. I mean, there's some basic stuff that's been around for some years, helping you get on tickets and everything, but there's some significant AI being built for law. I guess they just haven't figured out the billable hours model yet. Maybe when they figure that out.
No, I've got to believe, you know, I spent a decent amount of my time in contract negotiations, and I think those of us who have engaged in that, you know, to understand that the logic and language, there's an opportunity to have that more standardized and perhaps have our friends in the legal profession focus on higher value tasks. So that was a surprise. I think it should be studied a little bit more, but I personally believe that's going to be, you know, right up there in terms of, you know, various scenarios that will be applied.
I sure hope so. Imagine studying for 8 years, 10 years, whatever. You become a lawyer. It's wonderful. It's amazing. And you read contracts for a living.
I mean, right.
we need a machine here. Yeah. Absolutely. Stefano, one of the things Jeremy just said is that sales and marketing was not using AI as much or to the same degree as some other industries. You're in the marketing space at Wharton teaching about that and the AI space. What's going on here? Certainly in the ad world, we've seen a lot of AI. We've seen Google and Facebook, Meta, I should say, other big platforms start building generative AI ad units. You know, tell us what you want. Tell us where you want people to go. We'll build an ad unit. We'll build 50 million ad units and give them to individual people. We started to see stuff like that. We're seeing a lot of AI in targeting, in optimization for ad networks. Why is there this gap on the marketing side and the sales side?
Yeah, as a marketing professor teaching AI, I suppose I should be to blame. I don't know. But I think
that, You get a couple years. You're okay.
I think it was a bit concerning and also surprising to me, because if you, I mean, set aside for a moment generative AI, Yeah, look at the last 10, 15 years of technology in business. And you ask a question, which business function has been affected the most? I'd say that there's a good case for marketing. You know, think about any of the four P's of marketing, you know, product, price, distribution, communication. Basically everywhere, you know, automation and AI have been crucial. Take advertising, right? So just the shift to digital advertising and the ad networks, which we're just saying. Think about, you know, function like market research and be able to, you know, national language processing and customer sentiment analysis and all of that that you can do online with algorithms. And the list goes on. And so you'd expect marketing to be, by this point, to be pretty much on top of new tech. And then you think about this particular new tech, right? So there's been, so for example, to me, and I don't want to sound controversial, but to me, there's been an enormous amount of marketeers going crazy over things like crypto and the metaverse. And now we find in this survey on generative AI that actually they are lagging behind on everything. And I'm thinking, you guys, come on. This is the technology that is going to affect the most your job, because it's about content creation. It's about marketing. It's about making stuff, you know, social media posts, about advertising copywriting. It's about websites. It's about sales support materials. It's about value proposition and that kind of stuff. I mean, this is what marketers do. And basically, Gen AI can do that or help you do it. Right? So the fact that they seem to be the function that lags most behind, to me, that's concerning. I'm expecting it'll change, but I wasn't expecting. That's one of the surprises for me.
I'm not going to dive too deeply right now into what that means for the types of people who are in marketing. But
well, Dan, one of the things is, like, if I take, you know, the look that we do with marketing officers and their colleagues at, you know, large brands, I think one of the concerns I have about the adoption of technology in the function is any belief that this is going to replace some of the needed strategy those brands have. Then I can outsource all of my content creation, et cetera. And using technology yourself, it needs to have a strategy. When you're prompting it, when you're giving it a feedback, ask it for a result or content back. It will give you content back. Now, whether that is going to be targeted to the appropriate audience with the appropriate word, that all still takes a tremendous amount of experience and strategy from the marketing leader. And so I think that's going to be the key, is those brands and those leaders who, you know, really are able to articulate their strategies in a way that can be used as a prompt to create the appropriate content. Is going to be, they're going to find, you know, amazing, powerful use out of this. Otherwise, it's garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah, if I can add to that, I think one way to frame, even beyond marketing in general, one way that I think about what generative AI is doing, thinking about, okay, what is innovation? Typically, we define innovation as new and useful, okay? And now you could say that with generative AI, the cost of new has gone to zero. You can create content at the tip of a finger. And so the cost of new is basically zero, but the cost of useful hasn't gone down, because you still need someone to figure out. And generative AI may be able to help with that too. But that's exactly, I think, what the general was pointing to, the fact that it still takes a lot of expertise to see 1 million different, you know, slogans or social media posts or nice images for whatever product and figure out which one is the right one. You know, that. So in a way, we're no longer we're moving from being artists to being art critics, you know, like from being the people who make it to the people who curate it, you know, the people who understand where the value lies when you see something. You know, a lot of people see the same thing, and I see, you know, see something different, I see value. And so that, I think, is the way what generative AI is going to do to people.
I really like that thought. I really like that idea. And that makes a ton of sense. I'm a subscriber to ChatGPT OpenAI, and I recently got the DALL-E 3 update, so I can use that. Sometimes I'm like weeks behind everybody else getting all the cool new features on ChatGPT. I'm like, hey, roll it out to me. I'm here. But I got this one like, you know, second day or something. That was cool. Of course, I said, make me a cool space station, futuristic, orbiting Saturn, right? And there is not a shortage of images like that. It's interesting, the correlation to attention. right? And information. We've exploded the amount of information. I'm talking pre-AI, pre-generative AI, and attention span, you know, the amount of available human attention in the world hasn't really gone up, hasn't really scaled, at least not per person, right? And now we're just opening the floodgates on more that we can create, more that we can build easily, amazingly, incredibly. So being an art critic and being a curator and finding the right things and using them at the right time, that's super interesting. It's relevant to what we talked about earlier, which is how are we working together with generative AI? How are we generating the most impact and the most competitive advantage? I want to kind of end there and ask you guys both to put on your wizard hat, look into your crystal ball and look out 2-3 years for us and reimagine the world of work with the generative AI tools that we will build, that we will have available. What does it look like? Who wants to take first crack?
Okay, I'll say something. I have to say, I am not going to make a prediction. I'm going to make a wish. I'm going to tell you what I hope it will happen. I don't know that it will happen. What I hope that will happen is 2 things. First, that we get AI right, meaning if I look at other technologies being rolled out in the market at scale, at speed, global, in the past few years, I don't think we've always done a great job. And social media comes to mind to me, like it has generated enormous externalities for people. And I hope we do better this time because I don't think we can afford to do a bad job at rolling it out. That's the first thought. The second thought is there's lots of discussion about human replacement. You know, the fact that this technology is essentially now automating our brains and therefore is making really, humans to some extent obsolete. That's a fear. That's a dystopian kind of scenario. And my hope is that I see so much potential for good with this technology. And I'm hoping that instead of human replacement, we'll see human flourishing. That instead of feeling useless, you'll feel empowered, you'll feel inspired, and you'll feel able to actually do what you do best rather than feeling that you're no longer needed. So that's my hope. And I think I'm optimistic about a lot of things. In my own experience using it, I see what it can do. I feel, it can save me a lot of time. Even better, can be my sparring partner, can be my friend, helping me think, sort of. And I'm really looking forward to these things getting better and me learning how to do it. And I hope there will be many people like that. But certainly what I would like to, just to argue, and I make this quote to my students, and I talk about the Pericles, the leader of the ancient Greece, Athens, Golden Age Athens. Mm-hmm. And he said this thing about politics, a famous quote, and I think it can be repurposed for AI. And his quote was, even if you don't, like paraphrasing, but even if you don't take an interest in politics, politics will take an interest in you. And I think this is AI. You may or may not be the tech person. You may not be interested in this. You know, I see a lot of people who are just not very, interested in learning, figuring out, trying it out, trying to work out the scenarios, the implications. And that's fine. Everybody has their own interest. But I don't think we can afford not to care about this because it's going to affect everybody.
And the crystal ball shifts to Jeremy.
Yeah, by now I should be smart enough to go before Stefan, not after. But I like the pivot in terms of the hope. I think, a couple hopes that I have based on, what I've seen thus far and some of the research that both we've done and others have done. And one is that I think we've all been part of organizations and groups where, some people are better communicators than others. But everybody has something to offer. And I think one of the hopes I have for AI is going to allow some of those ideas to be more effectively articulated such that we can put them into act. So perhaps those who don't write almost every day, like those of us on this today or came from a liberal arts background, who have that capability, hopefully to do it, that this is their co-pilot that allows them to be more articulate and get the ideas up front. That's one I think I hope happened. Number two is we saw this in, some of the predictions and hopes that people responded to the survey, that is that allowing teams to do higher value work, really allowing humans to do more of the human aspect of the job, whether it's connecting with other people, connecting with customers, connecting with others in the organization, versus, you know, doing the more routine work that perhaps we can all outsource to the helpful agent over time. So those are my two hopes.
It's super interesting. I want to thank both of you for some of your thoughts and insights, and maybe cap it off with a couple of things that you've kind of just spurred in my own mind. The quote from Steve Jobs about what a computer is comes to mind. And he was talking about versus TV, which he was not a big fan of. But he said that the computer is a bicycle for the brain. In other words, an extender, an amplifier, an empowerer. It's interesting that we've seen in the past decade that companies have required fewer employees to generate massive impact. That really came to light when Instagram was sold for $2 billion and it had 17 employees, right? And that's pretty old now, but you see that again. Now, I talked to somebody recently on the Tech First podcast, said, hey, ChatGPT is my CMO, ChatGPT is my CFO, and other things. That's perhaps an exaggeration, but there's some reality there. And Jeremy, you just mentioned, you know, you don't write much. Well, you can now. Maybe you don't write code. Maybe you can now. And maybe what an individual or a small group or team or smaller company can do is be bigger than they are. And that'll be interesting to see how that impacts the world of work, how people and business in the future. I want to thank both of you for taking this time and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you. It's been fun.